Hating America. This is a great way to find out what is great about America, is by you know, who your harshest critics are. A natural and degenerate land. These are various stages. This is in its founding and in its pre-founding as colonies that Europe and the rest of the Levant, and certainly the East, they haven't really heard of us yet. A natural degenerate land from colonies to just the post-revolution. It decried it as too materialistic in the middle class. Its version of democracy was directionless, amplifying the worst impulses of the masses rather than the leadership of cultured superior intellect and an intellectual elite. And then from its founding through the 1860s, the distasteful republic. The resulting political system was an alternative to all existing societies, which had entranced some, it repelled others, and could be ignored by no one. In July 4th, 1821, speech in Washington before an audience, including the European Diplomatic Corps, then President and Unitarian John Quincy Adams explained that America represented a new type of government destined to cover the surface of the globe. It demolished at a stroke the lawfulness of all governments founded upon conquest. It swept away all the rubbish of accumulated centuries of servitude. That's a good Unitarian there. Then there's from 1865 to 1945, we see the fear of an American future. The United States had proved wrong its historic anti-American critics who said it could never succeed. This very success only inspired more anti-Americanism. One could well believe it was headed for world economic domination and that others must copy its methods or fall far behind. The anti-Americans believed that while the United States had become highly productive, it had come at a significant cost to cultural and spiritual values. The cost of the enterprise seemed too high for these critics who felt that it had literally sold its soul to attain material riches. And then, of course, there's America's the horrible fate. To the communists and fascists of Europe, and this is, you know, in their early stages, the American social, cultural, and political system was portrayed as terrible in its own right, as the embodiment of soulless industrialization and all-powerful capitalism. That's what this photo's for. Europeans feared that this model would spread to their own countries and other countries. Also, there was a belief that the United States was becoming more powerful and thus posed a direct threat of imposing its control and transforming them in a despicable image, which is, here's an example of some of the Soviet propaganda. Then, of course, Yankee go home. From the 1950s to the 1980s, the United States and Latin America shared the experience of waging independence wars against European colonialism, Britain and Spain, respectively. Yet, almost from the start, Latin Americans reestablished their identification with Spain and shared much of the European anti-American critique. They did not welcome U.S.-style liberal democracy or its anti-traditional approach. Their society was based on big estates, oligarchy, centralization, and a very strong church. But while they rejected the mass industrialized society built in the United States, they were also envious of that country, all too conscious of their own failure to make dramatic progress. Combined with the U.S.'s Latin American hemisphere's conflict with its global Cold War communist enemies. And of course, Cold War and Coca-Cola from 1945 to 1990. As the Soviet Union's main adversary, the United States was now central to the antagonisms of Moscow, communist states or parties, and radical movements. It was now the United States, not England or France, that was the world's chief imperialist power, which must be discredited and defeated. Promoting anti-Americanism was a way to weaken the U.S. side in the global Cold War battle and to undermine its local friends. The great Satan is where we are now. Reactions to 9/11, 2001, two types of anti-American responses. The first and more extreme was the idea, mainly in the Middle East and among Muslims, that bin Laden was right. The attacks were justified, and there had to be more armed struggle against the United States and its influence. The other approach, even more widespread in the Middle East and Muslim worlds and other areas as well, was to say there was truth in bin Laden's claims and large estimate, legitimate grievances against the United States, the attack itself was excessive and American influence should be fought with nonviolent means. And then, of course, the America as the super villain is what we have today with the revelations of Snowden, inspired by the fact that now the United States was the world's sole superpower, deprived even of the justification of protecting others from Soviet imperialism. The immense power of the United States in itself was a cause for mistrust and alarm, upsetting people whose nations or regions' fate seemed to be in America's hands. So my conclusion to this long barrage of ideas, I say I'm a libertarian simply because I don't know what's best for other people. I have a problem figuring out what's best for my family of five. Trying to find out what's best for the five of us is very tough, and I don't think I do a very good job at it all the time. What astounds me is the number of people who think they can tell 350 million people what's best for them. I want 350 million to 400 million laboratories, not 50 laboratories. Like all Cassandras, you write an alarming warning about the apocalypse in the hopes you can ward it off. But I think whether we do ward it off or not, we are at the end of the post-World War II global order, and a lot of things have to be rethought as a consequence of that. Instead of more freedom, we are taking it away with increasing regulations and laws. We now have more laws than anyone can keep track of in their head. Ignorantia juris non excusat is one of the oldest concepts in civilized society. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. Back when there were a modest and proportionate number of laws, that was just about doable. But in today's America, there are laws against everything, and any one of us at any time is unknowingly in breach of dozens of them. With the new omnibus bills, not even our elected officials know what they are. Big government is erecting a panopticon state, one that sees everything and regulates everything. As far as America is concerned, we still have some gumption left. The British journalist Brian Reed writes that Americans are self-righteous, gun-toting, military-loving, sister-Mary, abortion-hating, gay-loathing, foreigner-despising, non-passport-owning rednecks that think that God gave them the biggest manhood in the world so they can urinate on the rest of the planet. If one were to formulate it less disapprovingly, Brian Reed's anatomy of Americans equals culturally confident, self-reliant, patriotic, procreative, religious, democratic constitutionalists who believe in national sovereignty rather than ineffectual post-soi multilateralism. Even in its current transformation, the United States is still different than everyone else. I think it is clear that there is a big slab of the population here that is attracted to the idea of being like Europe. But Europe has only been able to be like Europe for the last 60 years because the United States has served as the guarantor of last resort. In effect, Germany does not need an army because the U.S. Army lives in Germany. And so Germany is being free to spend its defense budget on socialized health care and all other sorts of things. In effect, U.S. taxpayers pay for the German health care system. We still have 50,000 troops, what, 60-some years after the end of the Second World War. We still have 50,000 troops in Germany, which is ridiculous. And any time anybody talks about withdrawing them, as Rumsfeld did over 8 years ago, the argument was that the closure of those bases would be devastating for the surrounding German supermarkets and restaurants. So that is why the United States taxpayer pays to keep this vast army in Germany, because otherwise those supermarkets and restaurants would go out of business. So if America goes down the European path, who is going to be the sugar daddy for America in the way that America served as a sugar daddy for Europe? There is not one. But what heartens me is that America is not yet European. Unlike most of you, I was probably the only one, actually. I was very despondent by the results of Obama's election in 2008 and his reelection. But what was interesting to me has been the nature of the rebellion against the government spending, bailouts, and regulatory policies. You see, there was this financial crisis in 2008, which happened in a lot of countries and a lot of places. From Iceland to Bulgaria, you had massive demonstrations of people pounding on the door of Parliament saying, why didn't you, the government, do more for us? This is the only country in the Western world where a mass protest movement, the Tea Party, rose up saying, why don't you do less for us? Why don't you get the hell out of our pocket? Why don't you keep out of our lives, big government, and we'll do just fine? It speaks for a significant chunk of our population, and that differentiates the United States from most of the other Western nations. Today, we are creating transnational institutions that will end up being run by profoundly illiberal sources. For example, if you look at the biggest voting bloc of the United Nations, it is the Organization of the Islamic Conference. 58 nations who run things like the Human Rights Council at the UN. So in other words, these international institutions that were set up mainly by the United States at the end of in the late 1940s because the U.S. did not want to be an imperial superpower. So it created these transnational institutions that have now fallen remorselessly in the hands of the enemies of liberal societies. The world is changing rapidly around us. The larger forces at play in the developed world have left Europe too, too enfeebled to resist its remorseless transformation into Eurabia. And that call into question the future of much of the rest of the world, including the United States, Canada, and beyond. The key factors are demographic decline, the unsustainability of advanced Western social democratic states, and the third is civilization exhaustion. As for demographic decline, Europe and much of the developed world has simply given up, for the most part, having children. They have collapsed birth rates. Germany, Japan, and Italy are already in net population decline. They have upside-down family trees. There are four grandparents with two children and one grandchild. That doesn't have to go on for a long time until you're in serious trouble and you reach a point beyond which you cannot recover. And that's what a lot of European countries are at now. Some of them have just gone out of business. If you look at Eastern Europe, some of the countries that were until 20 years ago part of the Soviet bloc, they gave up having children and they're in population decline. There's no successor population. What happened to Western Europe is slightly different. In effect, Western Europe imported a large Muslim population to be the children it couldn't be bothered having themselves. Now, compared to the average ethnic European birth rate, where they have 1.3 children per couple, the estimated Muslim population, and by the way, I'm not being racist here, because the biggest Muslim population is Caucasian, meaning from the Caucasus, okay? So we're not talking about any particular race. We're talking a cultural situation here, okay? I lost my place. Okay, the estimated Muslim population is 3.5 children. Now, the official British statistics from the official British government statistic office say the Muslim population of the United Kingdom is growing 10 times faster than the general population. That doesn't have to go on for long for the numbers to even out. If you say you have, people think it takes a long time, but if you have 90% population, that is, and let's make it any kind of racial thing, let's call them Dworkins. So if you have 90% Dworkins and they have 1.3 children per couple and then you have 10% ethnic minority, you can call them the Ruritanians, call them whatever you want, but they have 3.5 children, that 90% and that 10% will have roughly the same number of grandchildren. So in other words, in two generations is all you need, and you've caught up. Two kinds of things that drive birth rates. One is its basic kind of economic improvement. People from a primitive agriculture society where you do need large numbers of children to work on the farm into more developed societies where you need fewer numbers of children. What happened in Europe has gone beyond that. In effect, the social democratic status says you don't need to worry about children or grandchildren or anything like that anymore. You're taken care of from cradle to grave. There is a relatively high price in taxation to be paid for that, and that is why having a child is expensive in the modern world today. So people have fewer children because it is an economic liability. So if you don't have to have them, why have them? 40% of German female university graduates are childless. We talk about the maternal instinct, but evidently it isn't that instinctive, not if you're German. The European welfare state, and we are rapidly deploying that here in the United States, depends on economic growth and population growth. If you look at their math problems, that they, when they do their forecasts, that's what it depends on. The former is now barely detectable, and the latter is already in reverse. I'm almost done. One page left. If you don't have welfare, a declining population is not a big problem, meaning if we're back to our laissez-faire government. It's a problem in a kind of cultural sense that you won't have a very hip-hop pop music business if you've got very few young people. If you lose your young people, you have some cultural consequences. In a declining population without welfare, there are cultural but not necessarily economic ones. I mean, Woodsville, New Hampshire, the population peaked in the 1810 census, and then what happened? The sheep farming industry in New Hampshire collapsed, people moved out to the west, people moved to the mill towns in southern New England, and Woodsville's population declined all the way to the 1940 census. But it didn't matter because they didn't have a welfare state predicated on the basis that there would be sufficient young people to pay for the retirements of the old people. Now, when we say retirement, by the way, we are talking about a problem that most societies before us never had. If you look at Greece, something like the best part of 300 professions in Greece, you are allowed to take retirement at 50. 50. So in other words, you work from 20-something to the age of 50, and then you spend 3 decades living at someone else's expense. Well, who is going to be that somebody else? If you don't have any children, you've got to import someone else. And the people that Europe decided to import have been the Muslims. From immigration rates to crippling pension liabilities has at its heart the same root case, a huge lack of babies. How would a nation survive, you may ask? Well, it depends on what you think a nation is. If a nation is just a zip code, if a nation is just a gate at LAX and it just happens to be an accumulation of the people who are standing around at the gate or for whatever until their flight is called, then yes, there will be a France, there will be a Netherlands, there will be an Italy, a Germany, and a Sweden. But if you think of a nation is the accumulated inheritance of its past, then there will be no France, there will be no Germany, and there will be no Italy. It was just a couple of days ago, a prominent politician in Angela Merkel's party in Germany called for the removal of crucifixes from German schools. Germans are post-Christian, like most of Europe, but it is part of their cultural inheritance that you will see crucifixes displayed in German schools. This Muslim lady is making the point that this now, she's a member of Angela Merkel's party in Germany, and she's making the reasonable point that these crucifixes no longer speak to what Germany is, and more to the point, what Germany will be in 20 years. So they are not going to, they're going to go. It means it doesn't even have to be anything that basic. If you look at British pubs, if you look at the English village pub, is there going to be a need for an English pub? Or, I mean, if you know English villages, well, from, university days of young people that study abroad. Now, if you go to those villages in Oxfordshire, you'll have a tiny little main street in which there will be 6, 7, 8 thriving pubs. Now, once that population becomes 20-30% Muslim, how many of those pubs are still going to be in business? So it affects everything. It transforms. You can't have this kind of population transformation without having a broader cultural, socioeconomic, and political transformation. I have more examples of Antwerp, but let me just jump ahead. It'd be hard-pressed to teach the Holocaust in schools. So when you have this kind of essentially population transformation, changes not only the present and the future, but it even changes the past, because the past has to be retrospectively brought into line with a new kind of political narrative or cultural narrative. A suicide bomber may be a weak weapon, but not against a weak culture. Islam has bet that we have expensive toys. We have got the best kind of aircraft carriers, we have the best kind of tanks, we have the best smart bombs, but that is a short-term advantage. If you want to pick a fight on a battlefield, if you want to pick a fight that is slightly more ambiguous, that does not actually, never actually calls out the force you up against onto the battlefield for a big tank battle. Then what matters is will. What matters is will, and they have a bet that the West does not have the will to defend itself. And they see that every day of the week. For example, in the way that Comedy Central, just a couple of years ago, caved in and censored the show South Park. You know, 12 years ago, South Park was able to do a Muhammad joke, and it went on the air, and it was broadcast, and nobody threatened to kill anybody over it. What has happened since then is that we have taught these people the lesson that if you threaten to kill and you threaten to murder and you threaten to intimidate, you don't actually have to kill or murder anyone. The culture will just cave anyways. I think that your civilization springs from a relatively narrow foundational source. I do not understand how you can look at most of the great artwork of Western civilization. I don't know how you can listen to Mozart or Brahms and say, you know, that it's just superfluous. It is not even necessary to be an observant Christian to hear the beauty of a great European Requiem Mass that springs from a Christian tradition. So the idea of trashing our civilization in the interests of, I think, a multicultural nullity has turned out to be a disaster. And I think it has left a great big hole where our identity ought to be. If you take the picture of an average 13-year-old in California today, and you take a picture of a 13-year-old from, say, where I'm from in Ohio in circa 1878, and you just put those two photographs side by side, which one of these people would you be willing to leave your house to if you were to go away for a weekend? Okay? I do not think it is a very difficult question to answer here. Now, that is fine when you're 13, but what happens when you extend adolescence? The President of the United States has just told us that if you're a 26-year-old, you can stay on your parents' health insurance, the health insurance plan. So he basically said, at 26, you're still a child. On your 27th birthday, you have to finally get in shape and finally move out of your parents' insurance agency. But until then, you are a child. What the problem is that we have essentially created a society of permanent adolescence where the important business, healthcare. Why is it people can't make their own healthcare arrangements? 50, 100, 200 years ago, we were able to do it all for ourselves. And what does that say about us? What kind of, when you insulate people from, when you insulate your citizens from almost all the basic pressures of life, what kind of citizenry do you end up with? And that is why I do think we are creating essentially a society of permanent adolescence, where we talk about our iPods, we talk about the music we listen to, we talk about cable packages, where we talk about everything important, but the important decisions of our lives are made by the government. We are now the brokest nation in history, and we've just told the rest of the world that we are incapable of serious course correction. And around the planet, prudent friends and enemies are planning for a post-American order. So at some point, reality has to intervene, either in the form of a total societal collapse or, one hopes, something marginally less convulsive. America is going to continue to live beyond its means on a scale unprecedented in history. Over $1 trillion in debt a year, to the point nobody in the world wants to lend us money, so Bernanke has to print money. We have the biggest gap between revenue and spending compared to any nation on earth. We borrow $188 million per hour, and no major country wants to lend us this amount. If America goes out of the world superpower business, there is nobody to take up the role. A world of chaos without security, order, or global trade. If you're spending $1 trillion a year that you don't have on nothing, it goes to nothing. Nothing can even say what this money goes to. It goes to bureaucracy, food stamps, and dependency. It doesn't go to anything real. We're going to get used to the spending, which is 25% of our gross domestic product. And at some point, people will have to pay for it, the way the Norwegians pay for it, the way the Belgians pay for it. We'll have to pay taxes that match what the government is spending. We have a very dangerous problem here. If the government can get us used to the spending, then 2 or 3 years down the line, taxes will fall in their way. when you consider that nearly a third of all the jobs are government jobs, which the private sector must pay for, and then add all the people dependent on some form of welfare, we have reached the point where more than 50% of voting adults are now dependent on government and can be counted on to vote to keep it or increase its size. If we don't find a way to stop and reverse this course, the idea of self-governance and individual freedom will be over, probably forever. We now have too many people in the cart and no longer enough people pulling it. We need to think on this when another politician suggests further increases in spending or regulation. Thank you.